Welcome back to the Defense Tech Podcast. I'm your host, Civilian Sydney. I created this podcast in order to gain a holistic understanding of the inner workings of government innovation. And what better way to do that than in real conversation with DoD innovators? We are in season two of the podcast, where we're going beyond borders to explore the role that space has in U.S. defense efforts. I am so excited for our conversation this week. I'm going to be talking with Alonzo Segura from Peraton, and we'll dive into some very interesting topics like program management from the government side, identifying technology needs, and tips for getting DoD funding. Alonzo Segura is the Director of Strategy at Peraton. He retired from the military in 2021, having served 20 years in the Air Force and an additional 2 years in the Space Force, where he was a career acquisitions officer, heavily involved in the research development and rapid fielding of new Air Force and Space Force programs. After retiring, Alonzo joined a venture-backed startup, where he ran the government portfolio from the startup side. He joined Peraton about a year ago and runs strategy and growth for their national security space portfolio, utilizing his robust experience in government program management. He is passionate about connecting the space industry with the DoD. Without further ado, enjoy this episode with Alonzo Segura. Hi, Alonzo. Welcome to the podcast and happy Friday. Thanks so much for joining me today. I've been looking forward to this conversation and happy to get to learn more about your background.
Hey, well, thank you for having me. Happy to spend some time with you talking about a topic I'm very passionate about.
Yeah, absolutely. So can you just start by walking us through your background? I know you have a military background and the industry side as well. First, can you run us through what your military background was, what your scope of work was, and what branches you were involved in?
For sure. So I retired in 2021. I spent a couple of decades doing what's called program management. The internal code for it is 6-3. I was in the Air Force the whole way through, but the final 2 years I was detailed to the Space Force. Of course, the Space Force being our newest service, they were still working on the inter-service transfers. So in terms of my job code and what I did as an acquisitions officer, I'm part of what they call the acquisition workforce for the Department of Defense. And so their job is anytime the DoD has a capability need of some sort, and it's a broad range of needs, right? Submarines, planes, satellites, services, IT systems. It is this workforce that translates that need and the funding that Congress appropriates into business deals. So I was on the government side of the table as a program manager.
Okay, cool. And now I know you're on the industry side, and I believe you've had experience on the industry side of that exact same thing, right? Can you walk us through, first of all, how you ended up retiring from the military and then joining a venture-backed startup, kind of how that transition happened?
Sure. So it's been, because of the type of business that I was in as a as an Air Force officer, which was program management, my day-to-day work just brought me in direct and constant contact with industry. I finished out my career in Los Angeles, and at the time, Los Angeles, and even now, is more so just a hub of new space industry companies, and it's just a very exciting place to work. So when I retired in 2021, I joined a venture-backed space startup, and I think joining fresh out of the military, a startup, just allowed me to learn a ton. I had the good fortune of experiencing a full business cycle. So everything from developing the leads to pursuit, capture, and then into execution itself. Then on the other side of the table, sitting down with the government program manager, now my customer, and delivering capability, meeting milestones, objectives, all the while keeping an eye on the company's growth targets and making sure we're making progress there. I think at a small business, or in my case, the startup, because it's a small team, everybody's wearing a bunch of hats. And that helped me get immersed on a number of disciplines across business that today I'm benefiting from. So after that, you know, intense couple of years, I went to my current company, which is Peraton. And at Peraton, I lead the strategy and growth efforts relative to the Space Force. since that's you know, what I'm most familiar with. And I'm very lucky in this position because it offers me the opportunity to apply, you know, my decades of service, my technical training, my programmatic and operational perspectives that I gained in uniform now toward the success and growth of Peraton in particular.
Yeah, absolutely. Going off of that, I know I mentioned earlier, you worked in program management on the government side, and then you ended up doing kind of the same thing on the industry side. Can you tell us how that flipped your perspective of things and how being on the other side of it may have helped you when you were on the industry side?
So there was some skills that directly translated. As a, you know, you do 20 years in program management for the government, there's going to be some unique things that just apply. So for example, resource management, you know, there's only so many people, so much funding, so much schedule margin to get to goal. Let's take risk management. Risk management, I think, translates from one to the other really well. A lot of, for example, how do you wrap your mind around a complex system or system of systems? Well, typically you come up with a work breakdown structure, very familiar with that type of thing. And then there's sort of the generic pro PM, PMP sort of problem solving, budgeting, conflict resolution, leadership in particular, I think is a foundational type of thing you can bring directly across. And so many skills directly applied on both sides of the table. However, there's also a whole new rainbow of new skills I've picked up. I would say performing as an industry PM on a firm fixed price project where the government keeps trying to, let's say, scope creep you a little bit, that is an eye-opening experience. There are additional things that are you'd think you understand, but it somehow hits different on the industry side. For example, having to deal with hiring or firing or being responsible for profit and loss, like directly impacting how the company does, coping with government security rules. It's a whole different ball game when you're doing it as a .com instead of .gov or a .mil. And I think probably one of the other ones that's been very different is managing relationships with primes or managing relationships with subs or peer-to-peer, industry-to-industry. That sort of relationship management has been very different and eye-opening.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm sure that was so interesting, especially with hiring and firing. I didn't think about that. That's probably not really an issue or a thought on the government side, right? Because they have that process in place.
Right. Well, so it is, but it just in industry it hits different. When you're, it just hits different.
Yeah, absolutely.
And certainly talent acquisition has been much different. When you put out an industry, you know, you need to fill a new BD role or a new PM or a new solutions architect, and you put those out and you're flooded with resumes and having to sort of parse and read and go through the interview and keeping in mind how you want your team to grow and who you want to work with. I think those have been really interesting to experience.
And how do you even go about in the very beginning identifying a technology need on the government side?
So this is a very, I'll give you the short version. There's a process for that, of course, and there's regulation on how you go about this. But typically, to identify a need, the textbook answer is you go through something called the JSIDS process, which can be, you know, years long and very frustrating in terms of what is it that you really need, a warfighter or operator. But if you go up just one level, there's also sort of tech push and tech pull. By pull, I mean you have an operator or someone in the field that has identified a gap and they're asking for help. Help me close this gap, acquisition or Pentagon. And this is the most common approach. And by tech push, on occasion, you have a lab or a power broker, and that can be a person or an organization within the service or an innovation unit. Think of like DIU or InQtel or those types of shops. and they discover a new technology and they push it for adoption within the water department. So that's kind of the initial dynamic. Is it a pull or a push? And if it's through the front door, let's say through JCIDS, and it takes a long time, once JCIDS puts out an up and it goes, yeah, Verily, this is a real need. Let's go build it. Let's go acquire. Then you need to put together the strategy of the business deal that you're going to make with industry. And again, this can take many, many years. And so frustration has grown over time in a wide variety of, let's call them workarounds, have come about. For example, there's something called urgent operational needs. So if you have a COCOM with an urgent need, they get these special, go straight kind of passes, and they can drive an immediate response. A good example of this is many years ago, during the Iraq war, there was the need for an MRAP, if you remember the armored transport vehicle. So the MRAP was an urgent operational need, and it went from an initial need statement, hey, we need to protect our people, to fielding in 18 months, which is incredibly fast for this type of system. Another example of a workaround more recent is under Heidi Chu at R&E. She started a program called the Rapid Defense Experimentation Reserve. And this is a fund that accelerates fielding of well-defined prototypes that match a need identified by a COCOM. And like I said, there's a wide variety of this. You've got, your WorkSys, your SpaceWorks, your SoftWorks, your AthWorks. You've got DIU, I mentioned Incutel. You've got your various accelerators. And all of these are trying to either do a tech push or a tech pull or get that need out for development or production. But by far, one of my favorite ways to identify a need is through experiments or gaming or tabletop exercises or real live exercises. So these exercises really reveal what is it that you need. And when you identify a warfighter gap, it doesn't always have to be met by buying something new. Sometimes it can be filled just by using the stuff you have already, but in a new way. And so as a warfighter or an operator being in a war game, you can put your tactics and your techniques and your doctrine and your policy through the ringer, identify what do I truly need, and after some thought, identify, well, I really do need to buy a new tank, spaceship, plane, submarine, missile, whatever it is, or maybe I just need to be smarter about how I use what I already have. So long answer, which is to say there's many ways to identify a need in something longer than others.
Yeah, that's super helpful. I'm curious, you said some technology needs can get the label of, was it urgent operational need? How did they get that label?
So it's been a bit since I checked the guidance. But going from memory, to be labeled, you have to, the need has to come from a combatant command. PACOM, CENTCOM. And you have to be performing in a named operation. Okay. And, you're nominated by that commander back to the Pentagon. Hey, I need this ASAP. Mm-hmm. And then the services in turn have to basically get a very urgently bypass as much as you can to deliver this capability because it is urgent to that particular COCOM or that operation.
That is fascinating. So how is the decision ultimately made on which needs are the most urgent, kind of outside of that urgent operational need, on which ones the government's going to move forward with, like, right now?
So first of all, each service, so you've got, the Navy and the Army and the Marines and the Space Force.
Yeah.
They're all going to attempt to align their budget when they put in the POM to a set of priorities. And those priorities are derived from the National Defense Strategy, which is itself derived from the White House, which is the National Security Policy. Yeah. And so this whole thing is, in theory, nested and supposed to fund resources that are aligned to what the commander-in-chief says, you know, is our go forward plan. In fact, the budget that comes out is called the president's budget. And and the issue is that this takes a long time, years in the process. And even after it's delivered, and we said, Congress, pretty please give me the funding I require to meet these needs, you have continuing resolutions. We're still in a continuing resolution right now in 2024, and it's March. Mm-hmm. So the process is not clean, and it takes time. And by the time the funding actually shows up, of course, the situation on the ground has changed, but you're locked into these budget lines where you can only, unless you go back to Congress and ask for a do-over, go and fund those specific things that you identified up to 2 years before. And this is actually what makes it so hard for small businesses or non-traditionals and even traditionals to do business, because the palm side, that sales cycle can take so long.
I see.
To get early.
There's a limited window where they can break in. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So switching gears a little bit, you're currently at Peraton. I'm wondering if you could describe kind of what Peraton does as a company and then its place in the larger atmosphere of defense tech.
Sure. So Peraton started in 2017, spun out of what was then Harris Corporation. And Peraton took a disaggregated set of businesses and created a foundation for the future of this mass. So the strategy for Peraton is focused on high consequence missions in emergent warfighter domains. So that's space, intel, cyber, defense, homeland security. It's a bunch of stuff. And then since then, Peraton has also acquired Solar's, Northrop Grumman Federal IT, Perspecta, all toward building this mission capability integrator and transformative IT enterprise across all of these different areas of technology. Today, I believe, in my role as a Space Force strategy lead, that our role is to partner with SSC and SPOC and STARCOM and help generate combat-ready crews that are equipped with the skills and the systems and the processes to do their mission, which is secure the nation's interest in, from, into space. So both enabling that thought process and that ability, that mentality, and delivering the kit required to do that mission, I think that's how we fit within, say, the Space Force. But for SPEC in particular, we are a large traditional business with in our capability, of course, like I said, it's tailored toward U.S. national security space programs. And on SPEC, you've got, I forget the count, 500, 600, 700 members already. And there are some traditional and a lot of non-traditional. And so I think the best teams through SPEC come together when you put a traditional partnered with a non-traditional. And so I think that's a role for us. We do a ton of ground systems. And on the ground systems bit, you know, I love it when people say space is hard, but I'm realizing that the ground is harder. There's a friend of mine, his name is Rhett Turnbull, and he told me that a Space Force without a ground system is like an Air Force without runways. And it really resonated with me because at Peraton, we're a particularly strong performer in end-to-end ground systems. So I would say to all the non-traditional spec companies that are particularly strong in the space segment and looking for a ground partner, let's chat.
Yeah, absolutely. So for the most part on this podcast, I've been talking with small non-traditional companies. Would you be able to share more about the efficiency of contracting at a large, mostly traditional company like Peraton versus a small venture-backed startup? What are the differences there in terms of literal contracting methods?
The efficiency and contracting dynamic, now that I've seen it, between a large traditional and a small non-traditional or venture-backed is fascinating to me. So a large defense firm is typically going to have a very efficient government proposal machine. And a traditional company is going to be extremely familiar with the FAR, which is, you know, the Federal Acquisition Regulation based acquisitions. They're going to understand how to decompose complex requirements, systems of systems. We understand the government and POM process. We understand the funding cycles. We understand source selection guidelines, funding flows, cyber and IT requirements, how to get an ATO quickly and efficiently, and how to operate on cost contracts. Those require you to comply with federal cost accounting standards. So your costs, your accounting systems have to be certified. And so this, the large businesses typically are have finely tuned proposal machines and execution machines to be able to propose against those RFPs coming out of the DoD.
When you say machines, do you mean like a literal team dedicated?
Yes, that's exactly okay. It. I mean, so like it's in its teams of teams with the processes and the business system support to ingest RFIs or RFPs or whatever other, you know, SAM type things come out or IDIQ type things come out and be able to return a fully compliant response back to the government.
Yeah, absolutely. I wasn't sure if you meant teams or like processes, but it sounds like it's all of the above. It just, they have a system in place for contracting.
Right.
So are there any challenges that are unique to larger contractors? I feel like people usually talk about the challenges of being a small non-traditional. I'm wondering if there are any on the flip side.
There are, I think, a challenge I've seen is that traditional companies, they may start doing work or have ongoing work, right, with the government. And a lot of this work can be classified. So that requires you to come into the office and go into the SCIF. And so what I've seen large companies continue to experience is the lingering effects of COVID and the work from home policies. So people, you know, we as a nation work for teams. So if working from home is okay. However, a lot of large defense firms have classified work, and this limits and constrains the ability for our staff to work from home. And, you know, as much as we try to be flexible and allow, you know, on and off days, but there's certainly plenty of small companies that have classified work and suffer that same sort of burden. But talent management and retention is difficult when there's just a lot of very bright, capable folks that can make the same or even more and still retain full flexibility to work remotely.
Yeah, that's a great answer. I didn't think about that, especially with COVID. People are so used to working from home, but you can't be if you are working with confidential material. So I know you're going to have a great answer to this next question. What would you say to startups who are planning to go after government-funded projects?
So let me start with, there's so much good advice and hard-won lessons learned and podcasts and books and blogs and LinkedIn posts. So I'll throw mine in for what it's worth. And I think there's many aspects to consider. For example, where are you in the growth stage as a startup? The approach you take to doing government work is going to look a little different if you're like a Series A than it would if you're later, say, in an expansion phase. But in general, some things to keep in mind is that when you look at working with DoD, but maybe you started purely commercial, you're going to be in for a rough ride. Startups in particular, your board has to understand what it's like to work with the government. And not just understand it, they need to support it. And for your board to support your business approach to the government, that means you have to have the right investors. So you have to pick the right VCs. So there's a whole lot of, you know, expectation management and carefully choosing what funding you go with. There's also the whole idea of dual use. Sometimes there's a shortcut. Well, I'm going to start commercial, then I'm going to pivot and sell to the government. And it's not panacea. It can work for some things, but not for everything. It's like a tool. They sometimes talk about, well, we need to do more fixed price contracts, or we need to do more, but it's just a tool. There's some applications for which your commercial product is going to be applicable. And there's some where it's just, it's not going to work, and you have to carefully weigh what is your product and what is the product market fit. Having said that, I still encourage non-traditionals and startups to continue to educate the government on the benefits of, for example, licensing models or as a service models, which typically the government is just not not very comfortable with. But that discussion needs to continue to happen. And you see already in their discussions and requests for proposals that they're starting to be more comfortable with those types of models. The other piece of advice, if you want to do government work, is to hire smartly. And I know CEOs and leadership is always like, well, of course, I'm always going to be hiring smartly. But in this case, for the government, if you don't have government people on your team, the easiest way to get the voice of the customer is to hire a recently retired or recently separated, someone that just took off the uniform and is hungry for something, you know, something hard with cool people. So bringing in someone that just retired or separated is a shortcut. It's a bridge right into understanding what they want. They being, you know, the .gov or your .mil. And short of that, short of bringing that voice directly in-house on the payroll, the other thing you can do is partner smartly. You want to do business with the government? There's a ton of firms doing business with the government. So find the right business partner for your prospect. And it's got to, again, you have to be thoughtful. Find someone that fits your growth stage. Find someone that will treat you as a partner and that will respect your IP. And I would say, final tip on this is you got to get really curious. And this isn't your typical sort of, you know, does the customer have, you know, the funding and the contract and the, you know, validated need? It's like, right. Get curious, get in there. It's not just, do they have funding? Help me understand, how do you get your funding? Where does it flow from? Who's doing your acquisition? So maybe you're talking to an operator. They don't buy things. The acquirers do. So who's your acquirer? Or maybe you're talking to the acquirer, but you really need to talk to also the requirement generator, the operator. So you need to understand for these three houses, the money, the deal, and the requirement, what are their pain points? What do they really need? And just try to walk, you know, a mile in their shoes. So that's, you know, lots of advice out there. That's three for me.
That's such great advice. I have one more question for you. So what would you say the role that the other transaction authority, the OTA, plays in relation to this conversation around tech startups and funding? How does the OTA enable small businesses in this way?
Yes, I have some thoughts on this. So the first one is, keep in mind, an OT is just an instrument for contracting. It does not in any way diminish the need to achieve the first principles, fundamentals, a meeting of the mind between the government and industry. Yes, OTs carry a much lower burden of regulatory baggage. It's a lot of stuff that you don't have to do, but they increase the demand for critical thinking on both parties. You have to very carefully think through what you would usually just rely on the FAR to tell you what to do. You know, I used to say, don't FAR up my OT, man. Like, FAR, F-A-R.
Yeah,
and it's
yeah.
Just, so that need to think through and apply critical thinking increases with OTs. However, it does lower the regulatory burden, and that means that you don't have to have a certified cost and accounting system to do a deal with the government to show them and expose them to new products and solutions. And it forces traditional players to partner with non-traditionals to a significant extent. So that's another way that we're bringing in new business and new industry. So it's goodness all around, but I'll reiterate, I think strongly that the best teams are a match of a non-traditional and a traditional. In that farther, when OTs, because they're for prototypes, at some point, they, if you're lucky, you did it right, they move into production. And that's where having a traditional really pays off, because we are certainly well versed in how to navigate scaling and security and all of that. And that's sort of an industry look at OTs. But there's also a government sort of practice that we need to consider. OTs are only as good as the government requirement. And what that means is that, like any other contract, the government, the requirement owner, is going to drive the risk level in terms of innovation. We often associate OTs with innovation and non-traditionals. But that's up to the government and how they build that requirement. In other words, if the program office writes a requirement that's crafted in a way that only a traditional can meet the bar, then just because it's on spec, it doesn't mean you're going to get innovation. Right. You're going to end up with a prototype proposal from the usual players. So I think there's a need for both sides of the table, again, to go back to it, to apply critical thinking. What is it that I really am here to do? Am I really building a prototype, or am I going to go build a production system and, you know, I'm just using an OT to maybe do it faster, even though that may not be the case.
Okay. Yeah, that's really great. So that's really all the questions I have for you. Is there anything else that you would like to speak on today or anything you'd like to share?
Yes, I'm always on the lookout for top talent. So check out careers.periton.com and hope you find something in there and come join a passionate team. Thank you so much for having me. It's been awesome.
It was my pleasure. I learned so much. I'm going to have to watch this right back after we hang out. But thank you so much for joining. It's been a pleasure, and I hope you have a great rest of your week.